Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The sounds of summer are so much more interesting when you know where they come from and why. And that's why I would love to take a canoe trip or hike a woodland trail with author, artist, naturalist, and prolific blogger Julie Zicafus. Instead, we'll enjoy some recorded sounds and conversation with Julie Zicafus. She joins us now by phone from her home in Southern Ohio. Welcome back to the show, Julie.
It's so good to hear your voice, Ann Fisher.
Speaking of sounds of summer, it's been way too long.
I know. I was like, when are you going to take your little nature break?
Well,
and here we are.
Well, it's how I rewarded myself for 2 weeks of vacation out in nature, away from the internet, is to be joined by you today on my first day back. So thanks again.
Oh, my pleasure. I'm so thrilled to be here.
You know, it doesn't matter what time of the year we talk. You always have lots of news in the world of nature. But does it get any crazier than in August?
You know what?
What is it?
Just like it's like being in a blender. It's incredible. I mean, we have these events going on, and we have our daughter headed for college in 2 weeks. And you know, I'm buying things like tiny hammers and packets of nails, and you know, it's like everything I think she might need, Band-Aids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And wondering, you know, how best to send her off. And it's just wow. It's crazy for a lot of people. August is just like a mill.
It is. It's crazy. Everyone's getting ready for something, but you're also out there listening and watching.
Yeah, absolutely. Every morning I get out. I try to get out for a couple, 3 hours every day without fail to see what's happening in the seasons, and it just tunes you in the most amazing way to the natural processes all around you.
So how is this August? Are you hearing the usual?
Yeah, I pretty much am. I mean, I would say that fall migration is starting later than usual, and I'm not sure why that is. But I think of August as fall because I'm a bird watcher, and we start to see crazy things at the feeder and young birds coming through the yard, and it's actually my favorite time of year to bird watch.
Well, let's listen to one bird right now. It's the wood thrush. How does that sound?
It sounds fabulous. But you know what I noticed about that is the ambient noise around it and
yeah.
The other birds that were singing in the background, which is always great fun for me because I can kind of tell what's living in the same place as the wood thrush. And this is this ear that I've developed over many years, actually, of listening to every natural sound that I hear and really trying to identify it, which sounds like a crazy thing to do. But to me, it's like the kind of appreciation that an experienced music aficionado has when listening to a symphony, picking out the piccolo, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that's what I love to do as I'm running. I listen and I take a little piece of paper with me and I write down everything I can hear singing. So in the background of that wood thrush tape, I heard an American robin just singing really lustily in the background.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment for my guest, Julie Zicafus, author, artist, natural historian, and avid birder, of course. Give us a call. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote recently about woodpeckers, specifically those that inhabit North Bend State Park in Harrisville, West Virginia. You called it your happy place, but it seems like a lot of places make you happy. Anyways, I wanted to know more about this place and why it attracts so many woodpeckers.
Well, it's this place that I kind of stumbled on. Some friends of mine told me it was a really good place to canoe. And it's actually an artificial impoundment that was created when the North Fork of the Hughes River was flooded about 13 years ago, I think. And it was flooded in order to provide water for the town of Harrisville and Cairo, West Virginia. And what the accidental thing that happened was that it drowned all this timber in the stream valley, and it made a nursery for red-headed woodpeckers, which is a bird that is vanishing throughout its range just due to habitat loss. Red-headed woodpeckers have a very specific habitat requirement, which is very large, mature trees with an open understory. And when you think about that, about the only place you're going to see something like that anymore is perhaps a very well-maintained cattle pasture or a city park. park or even a fairgrounds. And so these are the kind of places that redheaded woodpeckers are limited to now in Ohio. So they're really disappearing. So just across the line in West Virginia, I can go canoeing and I can count up to 70 redheaded woodpeckers in 1 3-hour paddle.
Wow. Are there other places like West Bend?
North Bend?
North Bend, I mean? Yeah.
Not that I have found. And the reason it's so amazing is because all the standing dead timber gave them basically a nursery. They could drill their holes in these dead trees and raise their young. And the birds are double brooding, which means they're having two clutches a year there. And they're at least two clutches, maybe even three. And there are active nests well into August as they're cranking out brood after brood of baby redheaded woodpeckers, which is such a thrilling thing for me. And it's so exciting, actually, that Birdwatchers Digest has organized an event with me and Birdwatchers Digest staff hosting it. We call it Birding Valhalla. And it's August 22 through 24 this month at North Bend State Park in Harrisville, West Virginia. And we're charging what I think is a pretty modest fee per person, which includes programs from me, field trips, and guiding. We are providing kayaks to everyone or a pontoon boat if they're not interested in paddling. Mm-hmm. And from August 22 to 24, we're going to be paddling around in North Bend and appreciating the redheaded woodpeckers, the green herons, the dragonflies, and all the amazing animals and birds that live there.
We'll have a link to that event on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Julie Zickafoos, once again, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. Now let's hear from the Eastern Towhee. Let's hear this one. Oh, I like that.
And a crow.
Yeah. Is there an echo in that room? Was it talking to another bird there?
There may have been. I couldn't pick it up over
okay.
the phone.
I could hear one in the back, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the classic drink your tea song of the Eastern Towhee. But they often sort of elaborate on that. And what I'm really enjoying now is we have an abundance of Eastern Towhees. The old name is rufous-sided towhee. But they feed at our feeders, and they bring their young into the feeders. And now the young males are practicing their songs for the first time. So I hear them out there every morning saying, drink your
tea,
drink your, you know, and they're trying to get it all down. And they will eventually because they copy their father's songs. But it's really cool to hear them sort of each one taking his own creative path toward getting to the song.
Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Beth.
Hi. Welcome back, Anne.
Thank you.
I have a question for Julie. I was at a party this weekend with Christy from the Wildlife Habitat Center, and they had mentioned that you had brought in one of the birds for help. And I just wondered if you have noticed any particular birds more this summer that needed to come for rehabilitation than others?
Well, you know, for some reason it's been my busted hawk summer, and I can't really say why that would be, but it's a frustration to me as a wildlife rehabilitator that everything that has come over the phone seems to be hurt and have a broken bone. Since I'm not a veterinarian, I've had to either transport or have the people who call me take their broken hawks to the Ohio Wildlife Center in Columbus. And that has been, I am so thankful for that center and for the dedicated volunteers and staff that work almost around the clock. I know that last year they took in well more than 3,000 broken animals, orphaned and injured animals and birds. And, you know, it's a continual amazement to me that they are pretty much the main rehab center going in Ohio, and the volume of animals they take care of, it's absolutely incredible. I shouldn't say they're the main center, but they certainly cover a very wide geographic area.
Why do you did write about this hawk hopping around in a nearby meadow, and these folks called you, I think, on the day of your daughter's graduation party.
Yeah, we were going to have 44 people for dinner that evening,
no big
and I
deal.
Got a call at 9. Sure, no problem. Let me go get this hawk.
But you did, and you did find somebody to transport it. It had a hurt wing, and it made me wonder how you can tell when a bird is hurt, because I've seen hawks, particularly fledglings, I guess you'd call them, hopping around in fields and stuff, and I just figure they're just learning the ropes. And what's the difference? How can you tell?
Often can be. Well, you know, any time that you approach a hawk and it doesn't take off, but it tries to get away from you by hopping, then you have a problem. You know, so the amazing thing about this bird is I rolled up in my car, I focused my binoculars on it, and it instantly started making for the woods. Even though I was inside a closed car and quite some distance away, hawks are so sharp, and it knew that its only chance at survival was to make cover. And it really kind of broke my heart to see a hawk reduced to hopping, but it had been attacked by a feral cat. And no hawk should ever be attacked by a cat.
How can you tell
the other way around
when that happens? How can you tell it was a cat?
Well, actually, it's pretty easy to tell with songbirds. With this hawk in particular, the homeowner had seen this cat around hunting rabbits, and she had made the supposition that the cat was the one that got the hawk. Yeah. It had been grounded for some other reason. It was quite emaciated when I found it, so it was probably having trouble finding food. It was a young juvenile. So for some reason, you know, its parents perhaps had stopped feeding it, and it wasn't making its way. So I hope they're able to help it. I hope that was everything I take to Ohio Wildlife Center.
It sure was cute.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, beautiful bird.
Author Marlene Condon wrote an opinion for the Washington Post that I wanted to ask you about. She criticized birdwatchers who have turned it into a competitive sport, sometimes at the expense of the very creatures that they seek to observe, you know, that kind of a thing. How do you find the balance when you're leading your groups? Because you lead pretty large groups sometimes.
Often do, yeah. And we're always kind of straddling that line of are we impacting these birds that we're enjoying? And you ask yourself that a lot. But you're in a difficult position as a field trip leader because let's say you're leading a field trip at the New River Birding and Nature Festival in West Virginia, which Bill and I have done for now 12 years, every spring. And you've got 35 people with you, and they all want to see a blue-winged warbler. And you can do this. You can bring them the blue-winged warbler with the magic of technology. What you try to do is you go to a place, you play the blue-winged warbler song a couple of times. The bird comes flying out of the shrubbery, perches in plain sight singing. Everybody sees it. You turn off your recording as soon as he shows up. Everybody goes away happy. The bird thinks, well, I've vanquished that enemy. You know, I've driven him away. but where it becomes a problem is a very heavily birded place, you know, unlike West Virginia. Let's say Cave Creek Canyon in Arizona, where everybody's going to see one elegant trogon that breeds on this little stretch of creek, right? So then when you have everybody going there and everybody playing the same tape over and over and over again to this poor bird, that's when it becomes a problem. So you do have to remain very sensitive to that and try not to tax the birds that you're trying to show to people. On the balance, though, I think that turning more people on to bird watching, showing them these birds and getting them out in the field is so worth doing and so worth a little consternation to a bird maybe once a year.
My guest is Julie Zicafus, author, artist, natural historian, and, of course, an incredibly experienced birder, bird expert, I should say. If you have any questions or comments for Julie, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Julie Zicafus, author, artist, natural historian, bird expert, you name it. If you have a question or comment for her, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And to continue our conversation about the hawk, so we were just talking about a hawk that had been injured, and Janet has a question about hawks. Hi, Janet. You're in from Columbus. You're on the air.
Hi. I've had a hawk swoop down a couple times at my bird feeder, and I was wondering if there's anything I could do to help prevent it from getting the beautiful birds.
Okay. Well, I just had a sharp-finned hawk take a pass at my bird feeder, too.
Okay.
And what we're in right now is high sort of juvenile dispersal for these young hawks. And so in Columbus, you have a kind of a special situation there. You have some urban Cooper's hawks who are breeding within city limits and doing very well eating birds at people's feeders. One of the things that I like to say is, if you're putting out bird food, you're feeding not just the seed eaters, but the predators as well. And
okay.
I encourage people to enjoy them, actually.
Okay. All right. That's fine.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot, yes. Janet.
Thank you.
Richard in Mount Vernon, you're on the air. Hi, Richard. Oops. Hi, Richard. You're on the air. Well, gall darn it. I don't know what happened to Richard, but maybe we can check on him.
He got swooped on by a Cooper's hawk.
Yeah, I don't know. We have to check on that. Anyways, my guest, once again, Julie Zicafus, author, artist, natural historian. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Julie, we've talked about your books before. They're beautiful. Tell us the names of them again, and then tell us what you're doing with your artistic efforts these days.
Sure, sure. Well, my first sort of major book came out in 2006. It was called Letters from Eden, and it was a bit of an experiment for me. It was essays arranged by the seasons, and it was very lavishly illustrated, about 150 paintings in there. Followed up with the sophomore effort, The Bluebird Effect, which came out in spring of 2006, and within a week had been selected by Oprah for her Book of the Week book club online.
Wait, 2006?
No, I'm sorry, 2012.
Okay, thank you. Wow, I was like freaking me out.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm so prolific. I do two books a year. So you know, quite a span in between the books, 6 years, but it takes me a very long time to do them because The Bluebird Effect had 350-plus paintings and drawings in it. So this is what I do for a living, but I've discovered a really, really fun thing. I've always wanted to do note cards featuring my paintings, and I have never acted on that impulse or that desire. And Gallison, which is Gallison Mud Puppy Press out of New York City, sent me an email one day saying, could we feature your paintings on note cards? Well, I jumped on that like the white on rice because mm-hmm. I've always wanted to do it, but I've wanted a top-of-the-line production on them, which, of course, I can't afford to do myself. So they've made this amazing little keepsake box of note cards, four designs, 16 cards, and it retails for a pretty modest price of $14. Mm-hmm. And I launched them on my social network and blog on July 13, and I have just sold my 500th box out of my studio, which has been a profound effort, but lots of fun, actually.
Well, congratulations. I can't wait to see them. You know, if anyone wants to learn more about this, they can go to your blog, right?
And they can go to my blog, Julie Zicafus,
website?
On Blogspot, or my website, right, which is simply juliezicafus.com.
Okay.
And you can find ordering information there.
Jennifer in Westerville, you're on the air with Julie Zicafus. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
I have a question, actually a two-part question. I don't know if you remember or not, but I tend to call every year. I have barred owls living on my property. I live on the side of the reservoir up in Westerville.
Yeah, I remember
Fantastic.
You.
Fantastic. Yep.
Yeah, they're still coming back. I've had them for 4 years now. I'm fairly attached. Year one, we had a male get killed by a passing car. He was hit by a car.
Hmm.
This year, the female who did remate, she flew into the side of a passing car. These birds fly incredibly low over a road that flies in front of my home. So my first question is there any way to encourage them to fly higher over the road? It makes me crazy.
Yep.
Probably not real practical. But the second thing is she did survive. When she flew into the side of the car, she, of course, hit the ground, and we were there pretty instantly because we tend to watch often out the windows. But she sort of staggered around a bit, and her wing was out in an odd angle, and I thought, oh, my God, it's
uh-oh.
Friday night. Where am I going to take this bird? So my next part of the question is, are there any Columbus area wildlife veterinarians after hours on the weekends? Because I couldn't find anyone, and thankfully, she did end up, her wing was fine. Her face sort of swelled up, and I thought, my God, she has a black eye. That's, mm-hmm. you know, that's how I interpreted it, but she has mm-hmm. gone on and been fine. So,
oh, are you lucky? Wow.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we were holding our breath. I sat outside and watched her for almost 3 hours to make sure she was okay.
You are the owl's angel, and that is wonderful. Well, you're blessed by the Ohio Wildlife Center in Columbus. They, Dr. Donald Burton and another veterinarian there are on staff, and there are often people at the clinic, which is the side door of Animal Care Unlimited, on Billingsley Road, on the Sawmill Road exit. There are often people there after hours, and there is a clinic number that you can call. Hopefully someone would pick up. And I think I can give you the clinic number over the air, but it would be good to have on hand.
Yeah, you can give the clinic number over the air if you have it. Sure.
Okay, it's 614-761-0134. I have it memorized because I call it a lot, and I refer people there a lot. They also have a wildlife hotline that is an 800 number that people call, and they often get a recording, but someone will get back to you. There is no dedicated wildlife veterinarian, especially overnight and emergency, other than the Ohio Wildlife Center, which is a nonprofit, and it's a miracle that we have them at all. I'm the one who gets, you know, me and a million other rehabbers around the state are the ones who get the weekend night calls, and we try to refer you as best we can. But, you know, the fact that there is a veterinarian or two up there who are willing to donate their time to help wild creatures is to me a great amazement. There is no one in Washington County who will work with me, and that's why I have to transport all my animals and birds to Columbus.
That's a long drive. Jennifer, thanks a lot. Good luck with the barred owls. That is good news. I was waiting for a tragedy story, but it turned out to be a good news story. But
I should also say there's nothing you can do to encourage barred owls not to swoop down on prey.
The first question.
They're going to do it.
That's what they're doing. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Julie Zickafoo, 614-292-8513. Let's listen to some non-bird sounds now. True katydids. So in the, are the katydids the chirp or the squawking in the background?
They're the ones that are going ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. It's that percussive
I'm hearing
rasping
quack, sound. Quack, quack, quack.
Yeah, it does come across like that. But, you know, when you're out in nature and it's all around you, this is just one of my very favorite natural sounds. The other cool thing about this sound is that it usually starts on, I mean, I mark my calendar by it, on the night of July 23rd, which is the night before my birthday.
Huh.
So I listen for it, and when I hear the first true katydid, I know that my birthday's coming, and it's got all kinds of nice associations for me. Right now, they are so loud and so present in the night sounds that we go out and just sit in lawn chairs in the dark and listen to them. And the only frustration is that I can't hear the howling coy wolves and the whinnying screech owls over the katydids, which I like to hear.
Okay. Pat in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Hello. I have a question about, I have a bunch of feeders out, and about four or five have the peanut chips in them. And I think the Blue Jays have had a real good breeding season because they about empty those things every day, and nobody else gets a chance. Even the woodpeckers, when the big boy comes in, they kind of compete with him. I'm wondering, I do have a cage around one of them, but
Great.
They just seem to hang on to it and stick their head in there and peck it out anyhow.
You're going to need a bigger
something else cake. Is there something else I can offer them to have them lay off the peanuts for a while?
Well, there's a couple of things. One of the things you're up against is the Blue Jays' natural behavior of caching food. And it's so frustrating to see a Blue Jay just load its gullet until it swells and then fly off and then come right back and do that. So they're hiding these peanuts all over the place in tree bark and holes in the ground, this kind of thing. So, yes, it is frustrating. I have a very cool feeder that feeds whole peanuts in the shell. And it all it looks like is a spiral. It looks like a Christmas wreath of spiraled metal.
Oh, okay.
And you stuff the whole peanuts in the shell into that, and the Blue Jays take them away, but it occupies them for longer because they've got to crack the peanut and take the meats out. So that's one thing you can do that's kind of fun to watch. But you alluded to what it's called an Elizabethan feeder, which is a feeder that's enclosed within a cage. And it sounds to me like the cage is simply not far enough from the peanut feeder to be effective for you. So I would encourage you to visit a Wild Birds Unlimited store where they're going to have the up-to-date, newest feeders, and just describe your problem, and they'll set you right up.
All right. Pat, thanks a lot for that call. Jerry, you're on the air. Hi, Jerry.
Morning. Julie, I have put up a screech owl box in my backyard. I've got about a half an acre back there and several trees, and I put that up for a screech owl, and American kestrels showed up, two of them, and they spent about 3 weeks, and the one would sit in the tree watching the other one in the house, and he would always have a mouse in his claws, and finally they left and never came back. I'm kind of thinking I need to move that box. If the kestrels don't like it, the owls probably won't either.
Well, it sounds like the kestrels liked it well enough. Is the box protected from predators by a baffle?
No, it's just up on the side of a tree. I climbed as high as I could. It's probably 30 feet up.
Yeah. Height is helpful, but it's not a deterrent to something like a raccoon. My best guess would be that you had a successful kestrel nesting that got cleaned out by a raccoon. So what I would encourage would be to mount the box on a pole that you can protect with a stovepipe-style baffle.
And
height is not perhaps as important as safety. So I know that it's very difficult to get a very, very super tall pole, but I would think 12 feet would be ample. And try and mount it in a fairly open area. If you're open enough for kestrels, you could get some pretty interesting things in that box. You could get great crested flycatcher. You could get kestrels. You could get flying squirrels. It'd be kind of neat. But
yeah,
you know what?
It's 30 feet from a beagle club, which is all it's 50 acres of grassland.
Ah, that would explain it. Yeah. Wow, you could get just about anything in there. That sounds like great habitat. But, yeah, I'm a big proponent of predator baffles because, unfortunately, these boxes often turn out to be predator feeders rather than nurseries.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry, for
You're
your
welcome.
Call. How do you where would a kestrel go themselves?
Usually they're using old flicker holes, woodpecker holes.
Oh, okay.
In dead trees, yeah. And you know, there are a lot of birds that depend on old woodpecker cavities, and they will enlarge them a little bit. But obviously, a kestrel doesn't have an excavating bill, so it needs to have a pre-existing cavity. They'll either use flicker or pileated woodpecker holes as well. Also, kestrels will nest in barns. They'll nest on shelves up in barns, so they're often nesting, and they'll often, even in cities like in downtown Marietta, I've seen them nesting in rotten soffits on old buildings. You know, going into cavities that have been formed by rot.
Let's see, Jerry in Columbus. Hi, Jerry, you're on the air.
A number of years ago, I saw a Kirtland warbler, and at the time, the census on the birds was about 500. I'm not up to speed on that now, but you know, with the Kirtland warbler, that was named after Dr. Kirtland, who was from Ohio. And we had a young man take us out who was from Sandusky, Ohio. And they gather around MIO, small town up in Michigan, population about 500. And By the way, you might want to talk about bird census, because we encountered a young man up by Whitefish Point on Lake Superior a few years ago. He was taking the census. The last I knew on the Kirtland, however, was about 500, and they only nest in trees that don't grow any more than 15 or 20 feet high. And if you could, Julie, give us any information on the census of birds and what the status of the Kirtland warbler is today, I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks, Jerry.
Sure. Well, the Kirtland's warbler situation, as he alludes, is a special one. This is a bird that is on the planet only by dint of our efforts to preserve it, because it nests only in jack pines that are under about 10 to 12 feet tall, and it is extremely beset by the brown-headed cowbird, which is a nest parasite. And so in order to keep Kirtland's warbler on planet Earth, we have to trap. Wildlife managers have to trap brown-headed cowbirds and execute them in great numbers in order to keep the Kirtland's warbler among our birds, because otherwise the brown-headed cowbird lays its eggs in its nest, and the brown-headed cowbird babies survive and kill off the Kirtland warbler nestlings. So it looks like, I'm searching online here for current census info, the record high of singing male Kirtland's warblers was in 2011. It was 1,828. I'm looking now for more recent data on that, the current population, but that would translate, one hopes, into perhaps 900 pairs of Kirtland's warbler now. I too, have made that pilgrimage up to Mayo, Michigan to see them, and I really recommend it, because it is very humbling to see the human effort that goes into preserving this species, keeping it here with us. And the careful fire management of the jack pine stands that it takes to maintain the habitat at exactly the right successional stage for these birds. Once those jack pines are above a certain height, the Kirtland's warblers leave.
And there's Chet Baker in the background.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, I tried to shut him out of the studio, and what I got was scratching and whining at the door. So you will hear him bark.
We welcome Chet. My guest is Julie Zicafus, author, artist, natural historian. If you have a question or comment for Julie, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest is Julie Zicafus, author, artist, natural historian. If you have a question or comment for Julie, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. If you want to learn more about the Birdwatchers Digest event being held in a couple weeks, you can check out the link at our website at wosu.org. And you can also go to Julie's website to learn more about those note cards that she's now designed. If you have a question or comment, once again, the phone number 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from John that's really interesting to me. Julie, he writes, I have Carolina wrens on my front porch eating dead bees every morning. There are two beehives on the porch. Can I collect dead bees, stingers and all, and mix them in with my suet that I use in the winter?
Thought that sounds kind of cool, but I'm a little nervous about mixing dead insects into suet unless the insects have been properly dehydrated. You might get a rot situation going on. I would prefer to see you perhaps dry them in the sun and offer them separately. Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily mix them in. That's interesting that you mentioned Carolina wrens. We have them nesting in hanging baskets on our front porch, and I just had something happen that I've never had happen before. The second nesting of Carolina wrens on our porch, they brought off three youngsters just fine in the first one, and female a female came in and relayed within days of their fledging, which I thought was very odd. And she laid four eggs, and three of them hatched. And we heard some altercations between the wrens, and it seemed that there were more than just a pair there, perhaps three or four individuals. And one of the Carolina wrens pecked the new babies to death, which was new behavior for me. And I've been watching these birds for easily 35 years. So
sounds almost human.
They would do that. Yeah, yeah. House wrens are noted as being real, you know, fans of infanticide. They'll go in and throw out eggs and babies in other birds' nests in order to take over their territories. But I'd never seen that behavior in Carolina wrens.
Ooh, that must have been kind of...
It was upsetting.
Yeah.
I wasn't happy about it. There's lots of things that birds do that I want to spank their little bottoms for, but what are you going to do?
Sherry in Doylestown. Hi, Sherry. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Julie.
Hi.
I just wanted to tell you that on May 23rd and May 28th, I saw a mountain bluebird.
Where were you?
I was here at my house. And,
Doylestown, Ohio?
Yes, in Ohio.
Oh, my goodness. And was it a male or female?
It was a male. It was beautiful,
wow.
And I got a really good look at it.
Yeah.
It wasn't too far from my, I was sitting out on the screened-in deck.
Uh-huh.
Porch, and I had my binoculars, and I heard a bluebird, and I thought it was just my eastern bluebirds.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw this beautiful turquoise-type color land on a tree directly in front of my my deck, and I got my binoculars, and I got a really good look at it.
Uh-huh.
In my mind, it was a mountain bluebird, and I know that's very rare, and I was just wondering if you have heard of any more recent sightings of the mountain bluebird in Ohio.
Well, you know, I have a person I can ask about that. Jim McCormick, the amazing naturalist, recently retired from ODNR, would be able to tell me, rattle off probably how many sightings in Ohio and what the dates were. I don't know if that would be a first of state for the state, but let me just check here. I'm going to Google mountain bluebird, Ohio.
Well,
and while we wait, I would say that Sherry can be quite sure what she's seen because the mountain bluebird is only blue. It's completely blue all over.
But it's like turquoise blue?
It was sort of a light turquoise. It's very pretty. Mm-hmm. It's not like our eastern bluebirds at all. Yeah.
But they sound alike.
Yeah, they sound actually a little bit different. Mountain bluebird has a
maybe
lower
just a
throat
little bit.
Voice.
Yeah. But
you know, it's one of those birds that if you've seen it, you've seen it. I suppose the only other completely blue bird that you would see in Ohio would be an indigo bunting. But that's a whole different color. It's much darker.
Oh, yeah.
It's not the pale cerulean blue that the, let's see, I've got University of Toledo. There was a bird seen in April 2009, a mountain bluebird in Ohio. So we know that there's a precedent. And I would say that there are probably a handful of records. The mountain bluebird is the most strongly migratory of all the bluebirds, and it's got a very long wing, and it routinely flies farther than any other bluebird. They winter in South Texas and sometimes down into Mexico, and they're flying as far. You know, the main breeding population is really in Canada and the Great Plains. So west of the Mississippi, Montana, right around in there, Montana, Wyoming, areas like that. And they're usually birds of some elevation. They usually breed at higher elevations.
So lucky Sherry. Sherry, tell us, where is Doylestown? It's in Wayne County, right?
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, that's classic habitat, too. That Amish country is just what a mountain bluebird would seek out. They often feed by hovering. And they don't necessarily need a lot of trees to perch on and still hunt the way eastern bluebirds do. They're quite accustomed to treeless expanses.
Okay.
Yeah,
cool.
So you've seen a wonderful and rare thing. That's just great.
Oh, it was so pretty. I've never seen any bird that was that color.
Well, yeah, they really take your breath away. They really do.
I hope that it comes back. I don't know. I wish that they would start nesting here.
You know, it's really not their habitat. So I think that what you saw was probably a vagrant. And
probably.
But, you know, surprisingly enough, sometimes these weird vagrants show up for years at a time in the same place in the same time. And for whatever reason, their little internal programs get whacked off up and, you know, they show up. So keep your eyes open.
Sherry, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. Julie, what kinds of things do create these vagrants? Could there be a climate change issue going on or anything like that?
In some cases, it's thought that warming temperatures in the north are bringing more southern birds up. Certainly, there are examples of that. Birds that are able to survive farther north than they ever have been able to. The Carolina wren that we mentioned earlier is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bird that's knocked back by extremely harsh winters because they are pretty heavily dependent on insects all winter, which is why our caller was trying to feed them bees.
Oh, okay.
And it's suet. There are birds that are definitely breeding well farther north than they ever did before, thanks to these warming temperatures. But again, a winter like we had last winter will really knock down their populations, when it gets very, very cold. But in general, vagrancy in birds is not explained by any one factor. It's often one bird's little internal GPS just gets out of whack, and they fly west instead of east, or east instead of west, or farther north than they should. There are some very odd ones that can predictably overshoot their natural migrations. There's a Brazilian flycatcher, South American flycatcher called the fork-tailed flycatcher, very spectacular bird, which in the fall makes a northward migration in South America, which is no big deal. But sometimes they just keep going, and they wind up in places like Martha's Vineyard and Cape Cod in October. And we don't know why, but they just do. And so this is one of the reasons that late summer and fall is such a fun time to bird, because you just never know what will show up.
Ed in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Hi, Ed.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
We have a small retention pond behind our house in the little community, and has ducks, which we enjoy. And they're going to change the flora, grass and stuff around the pond to help with erosion, supposedly. So I was just curious, number one, what would prevent our little ducks from coming back? And then number two, if you can address this, is it common or normal for like a snapping turtle to get a duck? Because we had that happen once, and I've never seen it since.
Yeah, I think I'll answer your first question first. I think a great deal of duck nesting success on small bodies of water in Ohio is linked to the abundance of snapping turtles in that water, because they are the single largest predator of ducklings. They're very, very hard on wood ducks and on mallards, which are our two main nesting species in this part of Ohio, at least. Snapping turtle predation is a real issue. And as far as vegetational changes, a lot of people have a tendency to want to sort of scour the edges of ponds and remove all the vegetation so it's just a greensward reaching down to the water. Well, unless they leave some shrubbery for these ducks to nest in, they're not going to have nesting ducks. So some of the birds in Marietta have gotten very creative. We have these beautiful hanging planters on our railroad bridge over the Muskingum River, and there's often a mallard or even a Canada goose nesting in those petunias. plopping a big old nest with 13 eggs in the middle of a planter. And they make it just fine. The babies actually leap out and off the railroad bridge and down to the water about 30 feet below. Pretty funny.
Thanks a lot, Ed, for that call. We have an email from Joy, who writes, "A Cooper's hawk has been building a nest in my backyard maple tree during the past 2 weeks. Have not seen them for several days. Is it too late to be building a nest?"
Oh, yes, indeed it is. And that's got to be a play nest. I think it's probably young birds who are practicing. And a lot of the raptors will do that. They'll bring sticks in and they'll just get going. But watch that nest next spring, because they may be thinking ahead. Yeah, it's definitely too late for them to initiate nesting, though.
Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. I've got a question about bird bath. I'd like to set up a small in-ground bird bath. Is that possible? And I'm in the neighborhood, Columbus neighborhood, so what are the suggestions? And I also want to make sure it doesn't turn into a mosquito breeder, or is that what I want?
No, you don't want to breed mosquitoes, especially not Asian tigers. So you want an in-ground bird bath. You want something that looks as natural as possible? Is that what you're after?
Yeah. Something
mm-hmm.
not put in the backyard that, you know, it's small. I can basically, I'll have to drain it because of the winters we get, but or will I have to?
Yeah, you'll probably have to drain it depending on your materials. I think the company is called Avian Aquatics. You might want to check that out online. There are a number of preformed stream beds that you can dig and install that are wonderful because they, you know, you don't have to worry about a liner, and they look natural. And the most important feature, I think, for a bird bath is a recirculating feature, because that constant burble of water attracts an amazing array of birds. I have a very simple creation outside my studio window called the Bird Spa, and it is basically an 8-gallon reservoir that looks like a flower pot. It's got a big old dish on top that I put natural rocks in, and it's got a recirculating fountain. And I have been keeping a list of the species of birds that have bathed in that bird spa, and we are up to 71. Which is crazy. And we've had things like red-headed woodpecker in summer, tanager, orchard, oriole, dick thistle, white-winged crossbill. I just can't even tell you how much we enjoy it. But the main feature is not, you know, the brand, but the fact that the water recirculates and makes a noise. So that's what I'd look for if I were you. I think I'd go for a preformed creek bed kind of arrangement and a recirculating pump. And then, of course, you will have to deactivate it in the winter because it's just too hard to keep it going when everything wants to freeze. But what I do in the winter is I put out a shallow plastic dish with, like, a small horse trough water de-icer in it, like an electric plug-in.
Clarence in Canton, you're on the air. Hi, Clarence.
Hi there. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I was talking to somebody about the bluebirds I have here. Hello?
Yep, you're on the air.
Okay. I was talking about somebody about bluebirds I have here, that the sparrows have kind of took over their nest. Have you ever heard anything?
Yes, that would be a house sparrow taking over the bluebird boxes. And I've been running bluebird boxes, a trail of about 25 of them since the early 80s. And the thing that I have learned in those years is that unless you are prepared to trap out all the house sparrows in the area, you should probably not try to attract bluebirds to an area where house sparrows are firmly established. Those areas would include farms where animals are being fed grain, areas near feeders where house sparrows are coming in flocks to eat, barns, chicken barns, any situation with chickens will attract house sparrows. If you only have a few house sparrows, there are things called in-box sparrow traps, which you can get from the North American Bluebird Society. Do you go on the internet?
Clarence?
I don't have no...
No internet?
Desire to go on that thing.
Okay. Okay.
This is why I asked. Yeah, but perhaps you have a friend who could look that up for you, because you can order these, mail order these in-box traps, which will catch. They have a little treadle on them, and when the sparrow enters the box, it traps the sparrow in the box. So that is what I recommend is eliminating the house sparrows in order to encourage bluebirds.
Okay, Clarence, thanks a lot for that call. We just have about 30 seconds, Julie, but we have an email from Diane who says, this past weekend there was a barred owl in our yard, and in the next tree there was a tall, thin bird with a long tail screaming at the owl. This was loud, continuous screaming. This went on for 10 minutes. Finally, the owl flew away along with the second owl we had not seen. Can you tell me what was going on?
Probably, that sounds kind of like a Cooper's hawk. They're extremely vocal.
Mm-hmm.
They'll go, gack, 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 if they're upset.
Uh-huh.
And I would guess that the owl was in the vicinity of the fledged young of the Cooper's hawk.
Okay.
And it was taken as a threat. But all birds take owls as threats and will mob them and scream if they see them in the daylight. And that's one reason owls like to be out at night, because they hate being screamed at.
Julie Zicafus, it has been a joy as usual. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Anne. Anytime.
Julie Zickafoos, author, artist, natural historian. We'll put links to her website and her blog on our website at WOSU.org so you can learn more about her upcoming events and also about those beautiful note cards. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.